The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We are on Amazon. We're on Stitcher. However you consume your podcasts, we're under Writers on Writing. We'd love it if you subscribe. We'd love it even more if you're so inclined, if you leave us a review. That helps so much. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at WOWKUCIFM. We're on Facebook, Writers on Writing KUCI. We both have websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone2rs.com. That's the housekeeping stuff. You can't miss us. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. Today, we're returning to poetry. I don't know about you, but I've been reading more poetry in the last year than maybe I ever have before. So this is a thrill today. The collection today, Fantasia for the Man in Blue, is knockout. It was a finalist for the National Book Award last year. And its author, Tommy Blount, grew up in Detroit, Michigan. He earned his MFA from Warren Wilson College. He is the author of the chapbook, What Are We Not For?, out in 2016. This poetry collection, Fantasia for the Man in Blue, was published last year by Four Wave Books. As I said, was a finalist for the National Book Award in Poetry. Tommy lives in Novi, Michigan, where he joins me from today. Tommy, welcome.
Thank you, Marie. Thank you for having me.
So we have time, and I always love hearing about how writers became writers and how poets became poets. So maybe we just talk a little bit about your growing up. If you were always a writer, it was in your DNA, or if you kind of came from a literary household or there was some awesome teacher. Tell me a little bit about that.
So unlike a lot of poets, I came to poetry, well, unlike and like a lot of poets, I should say, I came to poetry pretty late in life. I always say it was a social studies class in my undergraduate years at Michigan State University. And the social studies class was about the radical 60s. And it was a great class. I still remember it. And the professor was like this hippy dippy professor. He had like a weed clip on his waist and, you know, leather fringe and everything. And part of the curriculum was the Black Arts Movement. And along with that, we got this cassette tape, because this was still on the fringes of cassette CD transitions. And on that cassette was all of these lectures by various figures, you know, like there was, you know, Stokely Carmichael was on there and a bunch of other people. But then the last poets were on that disc as well. And then I got to Sonia Sanchez. And when I heard Sonia Sanchez, I did not know what to do with her. It was her poem, Summer Words Over Sister Attic. I know it by heart, but I won't recite it. But I didn't understand what she was saying, but the music of what she was saying, I understood that, right? So I didn't understand it, but I understood it. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute, hold on. And so I just started like trying to find everything I could of Sonia Sanchez. I read what I could. And from there, it went to Miri Baraka. And so then I started going, well, maybe I can try this. So this was about sophomore year of college. And so I signed up for this group called the Black Poets Society. And this was the first iteration of it at Michigan State University. And basically, we just held open mic. We featured at the open mic every time. And so I wrote, you know, I was writing these horrible poems, but I was trying to imitate Sonia Sanchez, right? And I think that imitation was very like instrumental to me, to my sort of self-learning. And so from there, I started taking like creative writing classes at the university. I was an advertising major.
Oh, funny.
Right. But I was taking these creative writing classes and taking like Black literature classes because I wanted to read more of Black Arts Movement. And then it wasn't until my senior year that I actually signed up for a poetry course, like an intro to poetry course. And it was with the poet Diane Wachowski, who has, you know, roots in California. And I didn't know who she was. And thank goodness I didn't know who she was, because I would have been freaked out. But she was so encouraging to me. I remember I had one meeting with her, because she would do like one-on-one sessions every week. And I remember having a meeting with her, and she said, I forgot what I said to her. I probably said, oh, I don't know how to do this poetry thing. And then she just said, oh, you're just a natural. You're just a natural. And that was like, huh. Yeah. So from there, but then after I left school, I should get to Vivi Francis because she's really the important part. So after I left Michigan State University, I had this excitement about poetry. You know, I joined a local poetry group and I was going to open mics in Detroit. And I had all this excitement about it. And I didn't quite know where to go with it until I went to this one open mic called the Broadside Poets Theater, which was run by Detroit poet Willie Williams. And after I had read Vivi Francis, who is a phenomenal poet, there's four now, wow, up to four collections. Yeah, I encourage anyone who's listening to this to read Vivi Francis. Her book, Blue Tail Fly, is her first book. Horse in the Dark, Forest Primeval. Oh yeah, it's three. All very important texts. Anyway, but this is before those books. So this was around 2003 or so. I was at the open mic and Vivi Francis beelines over to me and she sits down at the table across from me and she just stares at me and just startles me. And she asks, what are you doing with your poems? And I didn't know. I was waiting for someone to ask me that and to do that. So what followed was Vivi was running poetry classes out of her house. She had a handful of poets that she was drawn to, younger poets that she was drawn to, and she decided to run these poetry workshops out of her house. And so myself and a few other poets who are like doing really big things right now, Jamal May, Nandi Comer, Erica Foreman, oh, I'm missing people. I always do this. Folks who have, you know, who have books out now, especially Nandi Comer and Erica Foreman, their debut books came out in 2020 as well, yeah, at the same time as mine. Yeah. And so Vivi Francis basically said that she was looking for a different kind of community, a different kind of poetry community in Detroit for herself, right? So she took us and she said, I'm going to tell you every single thing I know, and I want you to use it. And I want you to, yeah, use it. Take it. And from there, my life just changed from, you know, it was the springboard where I found out what Cave Canem was, right? Which is, and I even heard of Warren Wilson, right? Matthew Osman, her husband, who's a phenomenal poet as well. He went to Warren Wilson and Jamal May went to Warren Wilson. So my journey in poetry has been one of a combination of, I would say, not luck, but kismet maybe, and just also series of people who believed in me, like single people who believed in me and saw something in me that I didn't see for myself.
Yeah, that's so important because I think early on people are very, the lack of confidence I think can get in people's way, you know. And I remember going around to a lot of teachers or mentors and saying, you know, do I have it or should I apply to veterinary school, you know?
I cannot tell you how many times I have spoken with relatives or friends. My cousin just said this to me the other day, who have said, oh, I used to write poetry. And yes, then I always go, what happened? Why aren't you still writing it? You know? Right. And of course they would have all these excuses. You know, my cousin last week, she's like, oh, I started going to church. I'm like, but the Bible is full of lyric and figuration and image and all these things. Like, so. Yeah.
I love that they're mutually exclusive. I can't go to church and write poetry.
Yes.
I can't.
Right. Isn't that funny?
Great. Well, you answered my next question, which is, you know, your voice is so singular and so strong. I think it's been described as like your language is like a call of danger and a call of ecstasy, which I thought was exactly right. Mm. And I was going to kind of ask how you developed that voice and if it was in part through imitation and it's at the very beginning. And it sounds like at the very beginning, it was that you try to imitate some of those poets as a springboard to finding your own voice. But that discovery of your own voice must have been super thrilling and combined with this confidence to do it.
Yeah, it was a journey that was on the page and beyond the page, like in my own life. So when I started working with Vivi, I wasn't out as like gay and queer. I'm a late bloomer. It was like, you know, I think I was like 24 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't out as like a gay man. And Vivi and I, we had a conversation, a very honest conversation. This is why I love her to this day. She's like my sister now. She challenged me about the poems I was writing. She's like, I'm concerned about, you know, I was writing these poems where women were women were in the poems, but they were in a poem, in the poems, in a very negative way that I didn't see, right? Verging on misogynistic. And so Vivi, as soon as she saw that, she set me down and she said, okay, you need to investigate what's going on here. And that sort of led into me sort of fully embracing off the page too, you know, my gayness, right? My queerness. That coupled with reading Carl Phillips, who is very influential to me, like he is with a lot of poets, his sort of labyrinthine syntax, like his very twisty syntax, right? These sort of long, complicated sentences that were coupled with his poem Sensuality. His earlier poems were also about discovering queerness and gayness and exploring sexuality on the page, right? Mm-hmm. In a way that was holy, in a way that was sacred, right? That was so liberating to me. So Carl Phillips and then Cyrus Castells, all of these people were early, they still influenced me, but they were like and Vivi Francis were like truly saying, hey, you can do this. You can go for it, right? Go into that interior space. You know, strip yourself bare on the page, be risky. Don't be afraid to appear unholy on the page or to appear wrong on the page, which is something that I still hold dear to myself. Not being afraid to be wrong on the page, not being afraid to come off bad. You know, for me, that's what poetry is for those kinds of contradictions and selflessness on the page. Uninhibitedness.
It really shows the whole spectrum of humanity, right? I mean, that's how your reader can see themselves in the poems, right? It's so interesting to come to understand your own sexuality through your art. And I don't know if I've ever heard that before, but it makes so much sense that you, you know, that the art became the vehicle through which you could confront yourself. And we always have these conversations about whether writing is therapeutic, and, you know, therapeutic writing is really for journals and it's not art, but this is something else. I think this is really interesting that you can use it as a vehicle of self-understanding and exploration that then allows the other person, the reader, to do the same thing.
Yes. Yeah. I used to sort of cringe at the idea when people would say, poetry can be therapeutic. It can be, right? But the trouble is when one lets the poem just be that, just be self-therapy, right? Because then when it's just that, it gets flat and dead, and there's no room for anyone else to enter into it, right? Which is how I approach poems. I start off with that sort of germ of biography or myself, right? And in the revision phase is when I revise and write until that self that's on the page is me, but is an alien version of me, a kind of avatar that is able to open their experience up and open their bodies up to other bodies to enter, to the reader to enter. At least that's what I hope for.
Maybe poetry should only be therapy for the reader, not for the writer, right?
Yeah, I agree.
So let's turn to this collection, and I'll let you kind of introduce it as a whole. It's so much. And so I will not do it justice.
I fail at explaining this book all of the time because there are so many. Yeah. And that's the point. So my journey with this collection was a difficult one, and not for the reasons that poets normally talk about, where they're saying, I had to cut poems and all of this and this and this. I'm fine with cutting poems and all that other stuff. The challenge for me, however, was challenging myself to take up space in a world that denies me access to spaces. Mm-hmm. So the central poem in the book is a quartet of poems. Sometimes I call them a poem, sometimes I call them a quartet of poems. But the central poem, the sort of impetus of the central poem came about after I had been pulled over, quote unquote, by the Novi Police Department, which is where I live, two times within a couple of months. And I was walking because at the, you know, at the advice of my doctor so that I wouldn't die or to sort of, you know, help, you know, from a premature death from, you know, diabetes, which kills a lot of Black people.
And irony on top of irony here.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And so the Quartet of Poems finds me trying to channel, rechannel and reshape rage, because that's what it was at first, was rage, and sort of taking it and not necessarily getting rid of that rage, because the rage is still there, but refashioning it in through the lens that I know, which is through the lens of desire and beauty and negotiations of beauty. And so when I talk about this book, yes, I do, you know, I do say, yeah, it's about, you know, race and sexuality and gender. But moreover, it is about beauty. And what I specifically mean by that is, when I look at America right now, I think a lot of the troubles have to do with these sort of conflicting notions of what beauty is. And so you have this majority of people, I'll say it, American white people and Western, you know, sort of notions of what beauty is, but specifically in America, it's this agree, it's this sort of homogenous thing of, this is beautiful. But when we see some, which is another way of saying, this is palatable, this is something that I can know, I can understand this. And so when something that defies that definition of beauty, it's deemed an intruder and is thus suppressed or killed or patrolled, like I was. So this book is, I like to say, this book is one testament to this, of this intruder, to this beauty that exists. But of course, it's like a mosaic self.
It's so interesting, because I would have, yes, said all of that. Then I also saw just a lot of power dynamics in here.
Yes, that too.
And you reclaiming the power. Mm-hmm. The opening poem is, and we're, I'd love for you to read it.
Yes.
And we can read this quartet of poems to show the shift of you reclaiming power over this situation and over this man. But the whole structure of the collection, I thought, was so smart, so brilliant, in that you can watch these quartet pieces set a stage, and then the poems that follow it kind of mirror that.
You got it.
Evolution of power, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the third section really has to do with family, your father, your father's power dynamic. So yeah, I would love to get into a lot of these. And maybe we start with that first Fantasia for Man in Blue that opens it. And that'll kind of set the stage for talking about it.
Sure.
I also want to say, before you read, it's so interesting, because I read the book and then I listened to you read a lot of the poems online. And my experience of listening to you read versus sitting down to read it myself was so totally different. Mm-hmm. And I loved that. You know, I just loved that it was a transformative, totally, I don't know, the emotional content, the way it read was so different in my head than it was when I heard you read it. So I encourage people.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, thank you for saying that.
Anyway, go ahead. I'll set the stage. Fantasia for Man, and we will do the first one, and then we'll chat.
Fantasia for the Man in Blue. You know good and well you can't be out here in the dark morning to take in the moon, full as the bowl of light attached to this police cruiser. Like a grayed elephant shoots air through its trunk before it charges off to safety from a mouse in one of those old black and white cartoons, you shriek in a debutante's pitch, even though there are reports you are as large as an elephant. Car thefts in the area, the man in blue explains after he asks, where do you think you're going? It's unusual to see your kind walking at this hour. You're an elephant who's really just a man sweating away in a mascot's costume. You mumble in a dress. You fumble for an address that isn't your address, but mine. Oh, you've done it now. Don't say anything else. Let me take over this body, soften what letters will bend. I am a poet after all. Don't worry, You'll see. He'll wish us a good morning and let us go after he bends us over the black hood.
At what point in time did you write this after the experience?
I probably started that jotting down stuff immediately. Yeah. I am a part of, I haven't done it in a while, but there's this email group called The Grind. And it was started by the poet Ross White, a few other poets. And, but he's kept it going for, oh gosh, it's been, I want to say 17 years or so. It's been a long time. And it's basically this email group made up of different groups. It started as just a poetry email group, but then it branched off into poetry and fiction. Anyway, I was in, so basically you write a poem every day for a month and then you email it to this group by midnight. And so, yeah, I think I was doing that when I started writing these, and there were a lot. And I think they started out as like, I think I was thinking about them as sonnet crowns or something. I don't know. But yes, like I think I wrote that night. And then of course, like with all my poems, I put it away for a while. So yeah, so it probably was when I started revisiting it, it probably was maybe 5 months after it.
How many Fantasia for Man in Blues are there?
Oh, geez. Well, it wasn't called that back then, I don't think. But there, oh gosh, there probably was 10 or so like chunks of mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm.
So would you read it as all one? It's a quartet of poems in here, but would you read it as all one poem?
You know, I see these as being separate poems, but they're doing something that I'm coming to find out that I'm obsessed with, which is the notion of revision. I love film. So I like this notion of like instant replay and revisiting a situation and replaying it and sort of recasting the players, changing the staging. So in that sense, I do see these as four poems, and they're meant to sort of, like you were saying, they're meant to sort of work together. They're working together to strike this note through the book, but they're separate poems.
Yeah. And so the poems that follow this in section one, this particular
mm-hmm. yes.
one in section one are mm-hmm. very, well, there are a lot of iterations of dealing with the police and arrests and race mm-hmm. and whatnot. And then section two, and we can read that one, then goes on to more sexualized poems, poems of desire yes. and ecstasy and whatnot. And I want to draw the listener's attention, if you weren't noting the elephant in poem one, I don't know how you wouldn't note the elephant in poem one.
There's an elephant in the room.
Watch out for you. Keep your eye on that elephant if you can't help it.
yeah.
And I don't know if it makes sense. Does it make sense to go to Fantasia for Man in Blue in section two so we can keep the structure conversation going?
Yeah.
Or is it worthwhile?
I think that's perfect.
Okay, let's do that. And then we can go back and revisit. There are a couple of poems in section one that also bear reading, but mm-hmm. there's too much. There's too much, Tommy. Too much is good.
Too much is good. Yeah. Fantasia for the Man in Blue. It's the great blue hero, elephant trunk hung, chewing the set and every man in it like the big star, a convincing replica in the distance video promises. He flashes before he flashes his long nightstick at hustlers and car thieves who know I want as much as you do now, touching yourself, pretending the man in blue would bend over backwards to protect you from the boredom of your unremarkable penis. You get off on this, even when it isn't on screen in front of you, all in your head. Let's say you're a criminal. You fit the description. You did everything of which you are accused. Now, say there's a deal on the table, then imagine that you are on the table. And like evidence, a bargain, if you let him, he swallows you, promises to forget the whole thing. Say you let him cuff you, every address ending in sir, the way your father taught you.
So great. This section has a lot of poetry about porn, gay porn. I'm just searching through here a little bit. Yeah. and desire and I still come back to this notion of power, because I do think that reclaiming of power in that poem is really, and kind of recasting, as you said, the situation.
Yes. So one of the other challenges I have posed for this book, because I love theater and I love movies. Yes, I'm glad I was trying to wait to talk about this, but I'm glad you brought up power. What I have charged these personas and the selves in these poems with is negotiating that interplay between actor and spectator, actor and audience, performer and audience. So your most poems, the speaker is on one kind of stage or another, and there is an audience of one kind or another. And so the idea of watching, which is why I used that epigraph from the Hilton Owls essay, GWTW, I think I got it right. Because in that essay, he's writing about Gone with the Wind, but he's also writing about, I think it's the Without Sanctuary photographs. And he was being asked to write about these photographs. And so he's like, contemplating the idea of why white people, which was his boss, is why white people want to see Black people experiencing trauma, or Black people rewriting trauma or writing about trauma, which is another, right, which is another way of getting at that sort of interplay between audience and performer. And so the idea of Man in Blue is a sort of misnomer. There are like many men in blue in this book. So in every, so like in the second section, the man in blue becomes the men in blue, which are these gay porn actors who are in blue, you know, men in blue movies, who are doing something that a lot of the performers in this book are doing, which is wrestling with the narratives around their selves and their bodies. There are times when someone is placing a narrative idea onto their bodies, and at times they fail to resist those narratives and assert their own. And then, but with these gay porn actors, I see them as asserting themselves and sometimes weaponizing their bodies, which is a, when you think about it on a surface level, Black men weaponizing their bodies, that's a horrible thing to say. But at the same time, in a sort of subversive way, there is a power to that too. There is a kind of power. So
as you're talking, there was also a poem in section one called Framing Deborah Shaw. And it's easy to look up the image that you're talking about.
Yes.
I loved your notes section at the back. Your notes gave me so many insights into, I was like, why don't we just tell me what I'm talking about? Okay.
I love note sections. When I read books of poems, I know people hate them. I love notes.
Oh, I love them. Yeah. I love them. I was a former lawyer, so I know all about footnotes. But, but yes, I will draw the listener's attention to, if they look up this image of a fashion designer, McQueen, who did an image of this woman in shackles and kind of a picture frame, and your homage to her. I love this reaction. I don't know if it's meta or what you'd call it, but your reaction to film and photographs and visual imagery. I mean, the best example is the cover art, which you wrote a fantastic piece about.
Thank you.
Cover art that people should also not miss. But I do think it's really interesting when a poem uses that form to commentate on another form and what it's trying to do. And you do that so much in here. And I thought, you know, that's kind of a great door in for people to explore their feelings about issues.
Yeah, for me, it's called ekphrastic. Or at least I use it generally. I know most people usually they use it to, you know, to describe, you know, poems being written about paintings. But I extend that term to sort of any kind of sort of artistic medium or film or porn or, you know, porno film, you know. Right. And this poem, Framing Deborah Shaw, I should talk about this. I first heard about it in Dana Thomas's dual memoir. That's what I call it, a dual memoir, on the fashion designers, John Galliano and Alexander McQueen. I think it's called Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of John Galliano and Alexander McQueen. And in one of the sort of anecdotes, they bring up Deborah Shaw, who was in one of McQueen's runway shows, and he asked her to wear this very questionable jewelry.
Mm-hmm.
My guest this morning is Tommy Blount. The book is Fantasia for the Man in Blue, published by Four Wave Books. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
Should I read the poem?
Please. Yeah. Okay.
And it begins with the epigraph from the model Deborah Shaw. I felt as if my body was in a picture frame, framing Deborah Shaw. A simple math of angles, really. Nothing too fussy. A square. Soldered at each corner, a ring. Sound design. Just thin enough not to be confused for shackles. There are no chains. Little bangles to meet her biceps, garter her strong upper thighs. See, there is room for her to slip out of them if she chooses. McQueen asked. She had a choice. Okay. 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 She was made aware of the frame, open to opening the show. To show, McQueen said. Aryan notions of beauty are ridiculous. So why not open? Her body as the entryway, her walk barely a walk, an animal scuttle. Does she even feel it? When her thighs pedal her down the steps, is there an ache? Her soles slosh the runway, filled with black water. It isn't that deep, a tributary to hop across, or a mouth open to trouble the hound-eyed camera sniff for the smell of genius. Everyone claps for her, or not for her. The simple black mesh dress, its beaded fringe. How, as graceless as she appears, she manages not a rip or tear. Isn't it a miracle? McQueen's folly, his imagination, a savagely dark and beautiful thing.
Talk about a poem about power, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I always frame this, it's my voice, but I always envisioned it as like a fashion critic who may or may not believe what they're saying here. Because when I had learned of the story and then I saw the video, I too, and I'm still going back and forth about it, I didn't know what to feel about that, right? Because Deborah Shaw is fantastic, and she was friends with McQueen. And the fact that at first she was resistant to it because it reminded the jewelry that she was wearing, the shackles and the going around, her wrists and things, reminded her of slavery, like of the collars and the manacles and things. And then McQueen, they were friends, and McQueen convinced her to like, oh no, it's not about that, explained it away. And so she ended up doing it. It's a beautiful collection.
An amazing image.
But it's troubling.
Very, yes, very.
Which is, again, my sort of poking at the notion of beauty and troubling it, because beauty for me and with this collection is something that is mutable, that's also dangerous, because the lengths that people are willing to go for the sake of whatever their notion of beauty is and what they're willing to do to other people for the sake of beauty.
Right. Yeah. I'm so glad you said that, because the whole time the couple of times that I have read this poem and this time too, I was like, I don't know how to feel about this.
Yeah. And I think that for me, poetry is a space where the poet can pose a question and not necessarily answer it. I'm not interested in poems that will answer the question for me. Just as I'm, like in my love of movies, I hate movies where, everything is spelled out at the end, right? I like a good sort of open ending, or something that leaves me with questions, that again leaves me room to enter into that space.
Yeah. Except in porn. Well, yeah, no, you want room porn. To.
yeah.
No, you want room to enter into that space.
That happens too. Yeah, that happens too, right? That happens. That happens, right? Porn and just in, American in cinema period, right? We go to these things. And I just finished James Baldwin's The Devil Finds Work, where he writes a lot about film, but specifically how Black audiences are figuring out spaces to insert themselves in these films with, mostly white casts, or in films that sort of miss the mark. He brings up Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and sort of films that think that they are, or filmmakers that think that they are addressing an issue, right? But they're not really considering all of the players in that issue. And so, and what I mean, you know, Black audiences, we sort of come to these films. It's like an active thing. We come to these movies and we sort of insert ourselves into the plot in a way. We bring something to it, right?
Yeah. Right, right. Okay, well, we should move on to, so we make sure we get through all the Fantasias to the Man in Blue. No, this is so good. Let's just stay here today.
Yeah.
This is fun.
This is fun.
Yeah, so let's move on to section three. So section three, Fantasia for the Man in Blue, again, opens this new section, which really, in my mind, was really a lot about family, power and family, your father, and some other poems in there. So now this poem transitions us kind of into that section.
Fantasia for the Man in Blue. You know that painting, right? Matisse's Icarus. No, not so much a body to speak of, a darker suggestion, an absence of a body, an outline surrounded in blue. That's you, what you were. I can see fitting the description if you were not denied a face, arms perhaps tattooed with a lover's name, a mother's face, some evidence of having a life and of your manhood. Where is it? Either way, the blue has its way with you. Its constellation of small destructions all around you. Shell casings. No, not so much the shell, just the evidence of the shell. A bright wound where a heart can't possibly exist.
Talk about that shift into Icarus and how he entered the scene. So we move away from kind of the elephant imagery and into the painting. And talk a little bit about how that came about.
The father actually appears earlier in the book too. And it's one of the kind of subtle ways, because he appears in Geppetto's Lament. So the notion of the father, he appears in Geppetto's Lament. And so.
But actually Geppetto's Lament is in this section three. It is to come. Yeah, it is to come.
Oh, look at me. I thought it was earlier.
Yeah, it's on its way, though.
It is. Oh, geez. I thought I put it earlier. Oh, that might have been an earlier draft. But yeah, so one of the things that I wanted to do when I was thinking about the construction of the book, is I wanted these tender moments. I wanted there to be little bursts of tenderness. And so this section starts to soften a bit from the previous sections, which introduce, like, we begin with like American history and Americana, and then we get into we introduce the notion of like brotherhood and brothers, you know, so like on a diasporic level and a familial level. And so here is where I wanted there to be a kind of, as best as I could, a kind of tenderness that moves away. So there's that. There's also, so with this father that I have introduced, he is my father and he's not my father. It's this sort of lyricized father, I call him. He's another one of those figures who is wrestling the narrative around his body, and he's not able to do it. He's not here to do it because I kill him and Icarus does the dishes. And so when we come back to him, or to a semblance of him, the poem, Portrait of My Father, where I used, like, this is actually my father's autopsy report I used details from my father's autopsy report with some sort of, manipulation, because I'm a poet, you know. But again, it's that idea of like starting off with like a germ of biography and then warping it into something else. But that poem is me sort of emerging and trying to grapple with this narrative for him, because he's not here to do it. But the poem, of course, can't do that with what's left, you know, with what's here, can't do it. So yeah, so this section is my way of sort of adding a bit of softness. Yeah.
There's a poem called The Suit, which is coming up here pretty quick too. Mm-hmm. And just the wound, it felt like he left on you, you know, this sort of transgenerational wounds that we so nicely impart on our children.
And again, it's, you know, what is the son, but like a recasted version of his father. He's the actor that fills in for the father when he's gone, right? He becomes, no matter how hard he or I like to think that I am not like him,
right?
But in more ways than I can say I am like him.
I love this idea of using his autopsy report as poetry. Mm-hmm. I mean, just from a writing level that you can,
I
just think of a bird gathering strings and twigs for the nest. And we do look around us to see what we can make art of, I think.
Yeah. And then also evidence, right? It's saying, no matter how darkly, it's saying, yeah, he lived. He was here. And here's what I have. And I'm going to try to piece him together in a way to sort of hearken to, you know, Pinocchio mythology, right? Sort of piece him together. There are things I am finding out now about my father that I didn't know, right? Including his name wasn't exactly the name that I had known. So nope. I just found that out. A cousin, yeah. He has like an extra middle name or something. So yeah.
And how long has he been gone?
Oh, he passed in 2005. He was 55. Yeah, he was 55.
Yikes.
I put it in the poem. Yeah, it's 55.
Yeah, I remember.
And using his autopsy, of course, that was difficult. As with a lot of his things, it took me a while to, quote unquote, throw it away or give it up. I do see this as a kind of throwing it away, a kind of purging of it, because I've held on to it for so long. His autopsy report, I mean. Mm-hmm. I didn't throw it away, but you know what I mean? Like I'm sort of throwing it out into the universe, relinquishing him, but also, you know, a lot of anger, right? That was there, a lot of resentment, which is not in the poem, which is not in this book, which I purposefully kept out of this book because, again, I didn't want it to be so insular that the reader couldn't get in. And
sounds like you do that through revision, right?
Yes.
Which came first in that poem? Was it the autopsy report or was it the poem that you then thought I could use this autopsy report to do what I want it to do? Like, did you use the, as we were talking about fractic poetry, was it like that or was it like, which came first?
You mean, did the
like, were you using the report as a writing prompt or you had the idea and you said, I can use this report?
Because I am a poet, I had the idea all along.
Okay.
Which actually describes a little bit of my process. One of the things that remains constant in my process is that I'm always looking at other, I call them other architectures. So I will, I'll take from movies or I'll take from theater, or I'll take from catalog, you know, or a manual and sort of figure out how I can take this familiar or not so familiar thing and transform it so that I am author of it, or I am co-author of it. Or that I can add something to it to sort of give new appreciation to the thing. Because I always want to go back to the thing, but I always want to, which is the challenge of ekphrastic poetry. I don't want to be repetitive, right? Imitate the thing.
Right. The poem's too long to read today, but I will again draw our readers' attention to this cover art. So that was a poem that was commissioned for you by the art museum. They showed you this image that's the image on the cover of the book, and then you were to write to it. Is that how that worked?
No, actually, the painting is called, I have to say his name because I always have to say Peter Williams' name. The painting is called Portrait of Christopher D. Fisher, Fourth Reich Skinhead. And it was painted by Peter Williams, who he lived in Detroit for a few years. And Detroit Institute of Arts, they had this program called, I always screw up the name, it's Artist Poetry, Poetry is Art or something like that. Anyway, they asked myself and a handful of other poets to pick a painting in the African-American gallery at Detroit Institute of Art. And I knew automatically what painting I wanted because Peter Williams' painting has like haunted me for years. Yeah. And it always found me, like even when I wasn't looking for it, it just found me and it would startle me every single time. That was actually that's the longest poem and the quickest a poem has arrived for
really?
Me. Yeah, I wrote it in a matter of a few months. Yeah, that was, yeah.
I've heard you say you write really well under pressure.
I'm finding that I do. I'm starting to figure that out. So the production of the book has taught me that. Martha Rhodes, who is you know, my dear friend and founder of Four Way Books, and she was my editor. She was also my teacher at Warren Wilson. She had been championing me for years. She always, every time she would see me, Tommy, send me poems. Where's the book, Tommy? Where's the book? Where's the book? And so one day she sent me this very sweet email, basically saying, you know, let's make a book. We'll come up with a schedule. And then if we need to push the deadline, that's fine. But we'll come up with a schedule and we'll see what happens. And I think I always say that the book happened instantaneously while I was like the structure of it and everything. It popped into my head like instantaneously. But I think all of those years that I was writing poems ever since, you know, being with Bobby Francis, I think I had been writing the book in my head and not realizing it. Mm-hmm. So that when that pressure came, it freed up something in me. I'm like, okay, there you go. You got it. You know?
Yeah.
This isn't to say that there wasn't like, you know, work after that. But
right, yeah. Right.
Yeah. So
I do find that there's nothing like a deadline, because writing, you don't have a deadline, right? I mean,
right.
No one's sitting out there waiting for your book to come out except you. Yeah. And so you just gotta make it happen. Well, let's do the last poem in the collection and then we'll end on some crafty stuff and then I'll quit bothering you.
Oh, you're no bother. This is
really fun. Okay, so this poem is it's the last in the book, and it closes everything out.
Fantasia for the Man in Blue. What should you have expected? It's still dark at this hour. There is a star in the crest of his shield, too small to shield a thing like the heart. You're like that Matisse painting of Icarus, you almost say, before you realize it's all wrong. The colors all mixed up in your head. No, you are the disobedient one, littering the spangled blue night with your dark tear. It's wrong to say this, you know, but the officer is so hot. You want to kiss him and run your fingers through his blonde hair. Sigh. Just look at the way the moon catches his metal. He shimmers like a handsome pistol.
I love how this one just pulls all of the sections together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we get to go back to Icarus. We get to go back to the sexual power play with the officer. And then it ends way back at the very beginning of, mm-hmm. you know, him just being a man with a gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why this poem sort of breaks the pattern, you know, of starting each collection with the Fantasia for the Man in Blue poem. It sort of acts as a kind of, I call it, you know, basically like a volta, right? In a sonnet, there's a turn in a sonnet. So one of the ways that I think about the book as a whole is as a sonnet. And so this last section is a volta, a sort of turning back into, because with the volta, you know, we sort of, the sonnet sort of goes from one level of speaking and then turns into, okay, this is what we're really talking about. And it's sort of it's always jarring. And it's usually the spot where, you know, casual readers or poetry will go, wait a minute, I don't get it. You know, it's that part. But this is sort of like a, you know, a turning back into the beginning of the collection. And again, because I don't like, you know, for there to be like the sense of definitive closure. I like this notion of ellipticalness and a sort of going back into sort of cyclicalness, because that's one of the ways that that's how I envision desire for one thing, which is like an elliptical thing that sort of keeps circling and circling. And also I wanted to end with an image of beauty that was all of those things I was talking about, mutable and dangerous and complicated, and both the gun and the cop, right? And the idea that here is this gay Black man saying the officer is hot, right? And which is something that we've admitted before, but and knowing everything that came before that, right? Like all of the historical stuff and all of the complications of that, knowing that, and then coming to this and arriving to this poem and having that image weighted with all of that was important to me.
Actually, in the middle of the poem, hearing you read it, I made that that observation earlier, hearing you read it versus reading it myself. There's a reference to a dark tear, which I had read when I read it myself, was dark tear. And I also just want to make the point of the fantastic wordplay throughout this whole book, which I guess is the job
Thank
of poetry.
Thank you.
Well, I'll never be a poet. But, you know, the double meaning of so many words in here and taking a word. I mean, there was another, I can't remember which poem it is, but there's a reference of, you're talking about a gun and the chamber spinning around like a rotary phone.
Oh, yeah. Aaron McKinney cleans his Mac.
Yes.
That was one of the fun things about putting this book together, because there's also phrases that repeat as well, and they repeat differently. Like, what is it? Too small to shield a thing like the heart, and too small, to, you know, that kind of thing. There are, on a sort of micro level, the same gestures that are happening on this major level. Like I said, of there being iterations of the man in blue, and it's appearing in these different iterations. It's also happening on the level of language too. Like you said, where the word tear and tear, right? Black hood that appears in the beginning of the collection, and in that first poem, black hood as being like, you know, neighborhood, but also the hood of the car, and also blackness as a black hood, which is an echo of brotherhood, which, you know, comes up in the book. So yeah, I had fun with
I don't know if you can teach that. I mean, it is so fun, and it's so pleasurable, A, for the reader. I'm sure it's pleasurable for you.
Yeah.
Like there's a line at the very beginning in How Sweet This Great Land, the white girl is arrested. And then the next line, by joy, or is it hunger? I mean, you know, as you're saying, there's just a ton of those.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that can be taught, or if it's just like a sense of humor, you know, you have it or you don't. I don't know.
So one of my little secret, because I have little secret joys when I write poems. So I started that poem with The White Girl Is Arrested because I wanted to begin a book the way that Toni Morrison begins her book Paradise, where she said they shoot the white girl first. I wanted something with that kind of the punch. So that was my little secret thing. But yeah, what you're talking about is what is it? Ellen Bryan Voigt calls it, I forgot the term she uses, parsing and like annotating a line. I think parsing is when you sort of, oh goodness, I forgot. Essentially, there are different ways of approaching the line, but one of the ways that I love approaching the line is creating these moments of like half meaning. I stole that from Ellen Bryan Voigt, this notion of half meaning, where you get to the end of the line and you think you have the information, which is one of the joys of poetry, I think. You get to the end of the line and it sort of misleads you, or it's not misleading you, right? It's adding a kind of subtext to the information you're about to arrive at in the completion of that sentence. That's one of my favorite things about writing poetry, is all the ways you can play around with the line and the control you can have on a reader. But also I love the lack of control you can have on a reader too.
Right.
That's fun for me as well.
They're like those childhood, we always had these childhood like jump roping things of Miss Lucy Had a Tugboat, and then, you know, you would switch it at the end, right?
Yes.
And it looks so pleasurable. Then you think, oh, I could do this. And then you sit down, you're like, no, I cannot do that. I cannot do that.
It does. Yeah, it does. It takes me a while.
Yeah, sure, I'll bet.
You know, hence why this book took, you know, 15 or so years to come to, you know.
Are you just like in the shower one day and you're like, oh my God, I thought of one. That's what I'm saying. Keep a little notepad in the shower. Yeah.
Right.
We didn't do as much writing advice. I hope we kind of taught people some things through example today, because I think that was the best way to do it. But is there writing or craft advice that has sustained you, or that you know, it sounds like a lot, but
yeah. One of the things this last year has reminded me of, because I've forgotten this, both on the page and off the page, is resting in the knowledge that I don't know, and not being afraid to say, I don't know, right? Mm-hmm. It's a little thing, but it's something that my therapist has had to remind me of. And so that's one of the things that follows me right into poetry. I haven't written anything in the past year, but even reading the poems of other people, because I've been doing a lot of that, resting in the notion of I don't know, creates an easy passage into a poem, because then you're submitting yourself to that poet, and you're able to listen more keenly. And in writing as well, when you're revising and you're going, okay, I don't know, and I'm going to let this draft do whatever it wants to do. I'm going to let it go where it needs to go, let it meander where it needs to meander. And that's difficult, especially for me, because I always want to even though I don't like closed endings of things, I always want, the impulse for me is to do that when I'm writing poems. Gabrielle Cavacaresi, who was a wonderful poet, told me, Gabrielle was one of my teachers at Warren Wilson and a dear friend of mine. Gabrielle said, when looking at a group of my poems while we were in the program, said, I just want you to realize that you're ending your poems in these sort of closed ways. She's like, Gabby said, you know, it's not something that's necessarily bad, but it's good to think about, right? So maybe that's another point too, is truly listening to your poems, truly listening to them. Mm. Yeah.
And maybe you can only do that with a little bit of time and space between writing them and looking
yes.
at them, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It's hard to do that in the moment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I can't tell you how much fun I had. This was so great.
Oh, Marie, this is so fun.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, we could stay here all day, but I guess we shouldn't. Radio frowns on that. So we can find you. I know you're on Twitter and Facebook.
Instagram.
Are there other ways to Instagram? And I just wanted to make a little plug for Four Way Books, and Will City Press published your chapbook before. I just think these small presses are so wonderful, and you had a little bit of chance to talk about the people there, but I just became aware of Four Way Books last year, and they just do such great work.
Great yeah. people, great poets, great people. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Good company.
So little plug for them. Well, we're going to keep our eye out for you and for the next one. And in the meantime, thanks so much. This was just great.
Thank you so much, Marie.
That was Tommy Blount. The book Fantasia for the Man in Blue is out and available by Four Way Press, Four Way Books. That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.